It's Wednesday, June 22nd, and if you're moving slower than the U.S. Senate, that's not a good sign. We start here. As new gun legislation is unveiled in Washington, new discrepancies are unveiled in Uvalde.
How about trying the door and see if it's unlocked?
Officials in Texas are now claiming police didn't even check to see if those classroom doors were unlocked. Meanwhile, several state election officials reveal a pressure campaign straight from the top.
The president interrupted and said, give the man what he needs, Rudy. He said, I will.
The extraordinary testimony and why it could be an even bigger problem now than on January 6th. And if you're accused of sexual assault, do settlements with 20 different women scream nothing to see here?
It is still a he said, she said thing, even though there's, 24 accusers with all of these allegations.
As Deshaun Watson tries to sidestep lawsuits, he might still be stuck on the sidelines. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. It's been nearly 1 month since an 18-year-old with an assault rifle stormed into an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, and opened fire. And a lot has happened since. In fact, just overnight, a bipartisan group of senators announced they have successfully cobbled together the most significant gun legislation in nearly 30 years.
87% of gun-owning households in America support making juvenile records available in the background check system, and this legislation will make that possible.
What's in this bill? Well, first of all, there's money for states that want to implement red flag laws or certain other anti-violence measures. States can also include violent juvenile crimes in their background checks. And perhaps most significantly, domestic abusers won't be able to buy a gun, even if they're in an informal relationship, like a boyfriend.
What we know is that in states that have taken this step already, there are 10% fewer intimate partner deaths.
However, there are several compromises in this bill, and one of those is it's not a lifetime ban for those domestic abusers. First-time offenders can regain their right to buy a gun. Still, though, this was a big lift from Republicans, and there are enough of them signed on to potentially break a Republican filibuster. All that happened within a month, and yet, in Uvalde, Texas, the bizarre thing is we are still waiting on basic information.
And we had numerous law enforcement officers and agencies that assisted with the safety release for those students.
Remember, directly after that shooting in late May, the head of the school police force, Chief Pete Arredondo, said emphatically that his team did everything they could. They could have pushed through doors, he said, but they were locked. They would have broken them down, but they were just too strong. And yet, at the Texas State House yesterday, we were told those officers were never actually seen even trying to open those classroom doors.
The only thing stopping a hallway of dedicated officers from entering room 111 and 112 was the on-scene commander, who decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children.
These are just some of the jaw-dropping details out of Uvalde, and ABC's Maria Villarreal was in Austin, Texas for all this. She joins us from the Capitol right now. And Maria, before we get into this hearing yesterday, can you just help me understand what it's been like for people in Uvalde, close to this tragedy?
Listen, Brad, I think tense is an understatement in this moment. A good reference is, for example, Parkland. I think 23 days after the shooting, you saw legislators in that state from both sides of the aisle come together and say, we need to do something. Enough is enough, right? In this case, it has been almost a month, and these families haven't even gotten preliminary reports.
Her story doesn't end May 24th, 2022. It can't.
We sat down in front of the Rubio family recently. They told us they had not heard from the school district, from the city, from DPS troopers, Rangers, FBI. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so, as you can imagine, for the families, this is frustrating, angering, sad even.
Think about how long she was there. She was scared. She was in pain.
For the community as a whole, I think they are more and more growing impatient and weary and very concerned about really who is leading them right now, not just in the city, but in the state as well.
And so that leads to this hearing at the State House where you are. What did we learn from this hearing yesterday?
We actually had two competing hearings happening at the state capitol. You had the House one that is still behind closed doors in executive session. This is the one where Chief Pete Arredondo actually came and testified for over 5 hours. And then you had the Senate hold their own hearing as well.
The officers had weapons. The children had none. The officers had body armor. The children had none. The officers had training. The subject had none.
The one that gave the most details finally was the DPS director, Steve McCraw. Some of the big nuggets that he talked about was the fact that right around 11:33 is when the shooter gets into the school. And in less than 4 minutes, there are at least seven officers on the scene getting ready to go in, if not already inside, including Chief Pete Arredondo.
There was a sufficient number of armed officers wearing body armor to isolate, distract, and neutralize the subject.
You know, so the idea that they didn't have what it takes to go inside and to take on the shooter just isn't true.
There is simply, between classrooms 111 and 112, no effective lock mechanisms there at all, right?
Correct.
How about trying the door and see if it's unlocked?
The radios, for example, weren't working. Arredondo said, I didn't have my radio. Well, the reality is that neither his radios with the school district nor the local police department's radios didn't work inside the building. The only radios that were working that day were from Border Patrol.
But like in the moments afterwards, the story from Arredondo was one of heroism. How does he explain the disconnect still?
You know, unfortunately, Pete Arredondo would not talk to us. We tried to meet him before he had his testimony in front of the House in that executive session, and we waited for 5 hours in the hallways to try and talk to him afterwards.
Having Pete still employed, knowing he is incapable of decision-making that saves lives, is terrifying. Him not cooperating with the investigations that are ongoing is also quite disheartening.
You know, what was very frustrating about the situation is he knows by now that families are frustrated and they want to hear from them. They're calling for him to not only be fired from his position within the school district, but to also take a leave of absence as a city council member.
Chief, just give us a few minutes.
We waited, and when he was done,
Chief, McCraw said that you were wrong in the moment.
As we started to follow him to the elevator, you know, we were asking him questions. He just refused to answer. And you know, I think that was his moment where maybe he could have said something and just chose not to.
No one is 100%, no one is at fault, but everybody screwed up.
We spoke with local representative Roland Gutierrez, and I asked him the question of, is this about Arredondo? Is this about McCraw? And he said, no, listen, there's enough responsibility and culpability to go around with everybody. But what we want and what this community needs is transparency and action. Yes, Chief Pete Arredondo is still the police chief at Uvalde ISD. But again, I think a lot more people have to answer a lot more questions before anybody feels like they can move forward.
Yeah, and transparency really does seem to be the thing here. Because back in Uvalde, you've had these information sessions that have been, in some cases, closed to the public because witnesses have said they feel intimidated by the crowd there. Some of the parents are saying, listen, our children were murdered. Don't tell me about being intimidated right now. Maria Villarreal there at the state capitol in Texas. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, you've probably never felt for poll workers this way until yesterday. The January 6th hearings continue after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Yesterday in Washington, the House Select Committee on January 6th held another day of hearings. Not about the attack on the Capitol last year, but if you can believe it, something perhaps even more disturbing. The theme yesterday was about the days right after the November election, in which President Trump and a handful of associates tried to misinform the public, which in some ways worked, and tried to convince state officials to disregard their own accurate vote tallies and instead install illegitimate pro-Trump electors, which, despite immense pressure, did not work.
I understand that you don't want to talk to me now, but I just want to bring some facts to your attention and talk to you as a fellow Republican.
But with this relentless campaign under the spotlight, let's head to the House right now. Let's go to ABC's chief Washington correspondent, Jonathan Carl. And John, we hear politicians describe the schemes to push bogus claims of voter fraud, but they always feel kind of general to me, like it was a lie or it was a big lie. Here you had witnesses describing state by state what Trump and his allies were trying to push them to do.
It's a really compelling story, Brad. I mean, these are Republican officials who supported Donald Trump, who were elected by people who voted and supported Donald Trump, who were under this immense pressure to overturn the election.
To quote the former president, during the conversation, he told me the election was rigged and that I won Arizona, unquote.
Rusty Bowers, Exhibit A.
Did you have such a conversation with the president?
I did have a conversation with the president. That certainly isn't it.
I mean, this is the Republican Speaker of the House in Arizona, longtime Trump supporter, and Trump turned the screws on him personally, twice calling him after the election.
He said that they did have proof, and I asked him, do you have names? For example, we have 200,000 illegal immigrants, some large number, 5,000 or 6,000 dead people, etc. And I said, do you have their names? Yes. Will you give them to me? Yes. The president interrupted and said, give the man what he needs, Rudy. He said, I will.
Several follow-ups with Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Jenna Ellison, and they wanted Bowers to use his power as the Speaker of the House to essentially throw out Joe Biden's electoral votes, which he had won in Arizona, and pass on this bogus slate of Trump electoral votes.
Did you ever receive from him that evidence either during the call, after the call, or to this day?
Never.
You hear Giuliani, effectively telling him, you're a Republican. We're all Republicans here, as if, we're all Republicans, so you should help us out.
And I said, look, you are asking me to do something that is counter to my oath, when I swore to the Constitution to uphold it.
Bowers told the committee that he believed that his oath to the Constitution, which he says is divinely inspired, so it's part of his faith, was more important than his status as a Republican.
And so for me to do that because somebody just asked me to is foreign to my very being. I will not do it.
He describes what happens when he refused to go along because they started to publicly pressure him.
But at home, up till even recently, it is the new pattern or a pattern in our lives to worry what will happen on Saturdays.
He was labeled a pedophile and a pervert and a corrupt politician. They were sending, trucks into his neighborhood blaring out this stuff through loudspeakers.
We had a daughter who was gravely ill, who was upset.
I mean, the personal toll that this took on this guy's life was really incredible. But he said that he doesn't regret it. He said this was the only moral thing to do was to refuse the orders of the president and the leader of his own party.
Yeah, and you could see him blinking back tears when he described how infuriated he was by this whole concept. And that's not the only state where this was happening, right? Because I remember speaking to the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, after Election Day. He's insisting everything was on the level. But just now, we're again learning just how much pressure he and his team were under with pretty specific, apparently made-up claims.
The committee looked at several other states. I mean, there was Michigan, there was Pennsylvania as well. But Brad Raffensperger's story is, again, incredibly compelling. He had that famous phone call that lasted over an hour on January 2nd.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
There were no votes to find. That was an accurate count that had been certified.
Raffensperger talked about how he continually had to push back on these claims. I mean, there was the famous claim that Giuliani was talking about, claiming that there were suitcases full of ballots.
And I don't have to be a genius to figure out that those votes are not legitimate votes. You don't put legitimate votes under a table.
No.
Wait until you throw the opposition out and in the middle of the night count them.
There were no suitcases full of ballots. This is how the voting process plays out.
If you watch the entirety of the video, you saw that these were election workers who were under the impression they were going to get to go home around 10, 10:30.
Raffensperger and other Georgia officials, Republicans, looked into all of these claims, and they were simply not true.
I have characterized at one point it was kind of like a shovel trying to empty the ocean. And yes, it was frustrating. I even have, you know, family members who I had to argue with about some of these things. And I would show them things. And the problem you have is you're getting to people's hearts.
We're so far ahead of these numbers. Even the phony ballots of Ruby Freeman, known scammer. You know the internet? You know what was trending on the internet? Where's Ruby? Because they thought she'd be in jail.
Lastly, John, then, because you talked about the pressure on officials, how does this play out among regular people? Because I'm imagining former President Trump is out there saying, here are specific people you can blame. And so, of course, regular folks, fans of his, turn their attention to those people in their mind who are now stealing election. And they're not all big, important public officials.
I mean, the most heartbreaking story we heard from Shea Moss. This is an election worker in Fulton County, Georgia.
A lot of threats. Wishing death upon me, telling me that, you know, I'll be in jail with my mother, and saying things like, be glad it's 2020 and not 1920.
She's not a political figure. She's somebody who's doing her job.
I've gained about 60 pounds. I just don't do nothing anymore. I don't want to go anywhere. I second guess everything that I do.
Her mother was also an election official, and they together found themselves out of nowhere accused by Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani of personally carrying out election fraud.
Tape earlier in the day of Ruby Freeman and Shea Freeman Moss and one other gentleman quite obviously surreptitiously passing around USB ports as if they're vials of heroin or cocaine.
Again, the allegations turned out to be completely and totally unfounded.
What was your mom actually handing you on that video?
A ginger mint.
But they found themselves, targeted with threats to their lives. The FBI at one point telling them it would be not wise for them to stay at home around January 6th. Can you imagine this, Brad? And their lives were turned upside down because the president of the United States and his lawyers were personally naming her and her mother, accusing them of something that they absolutely did not do.
Yeah, and what stuck out to me, John, is like because of how terrible this was, Shea Moss no longer works as an election worker. Elections officials are quitting. And so the question is, who's replacing them? Someone's got to take that job. And the big question looming now is, are they being replaced by people who might be quicker to flip results that they don't agree with? John Carl at the Capitol. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brad.
There are not many jobs in the United States that are as highly scrutinized or as highly paid as NFL quarterbacks. When teams select a quarterback, they are trusting that man with the direction, really, of a billion-dollar corporation. So when that employee is publicly accused of sexual assault or sexual misconduct by not one person, not by two people, but by 24 people, you would expect those corporations to be wary. Well, star quarterback Deshaun Watson has not become less valuable in the last year. He's become more valuable.
There was a team out there that wanted Deshaun Watson badly enough, that recognized him as a great young quarterback, that it was willing to give the richest guarantee the NFL has ever handed out.
Deshaun Watson was hired by the Cleveland Browns this offseason for nearly $250 million. And yesterday, weeks after that signing, attorneys announced he has reached a settlement with most of those alleged victims that had made these claims against him. Let's go to Mary Kate Cabot. She covers the Browns for Cleveland.com and for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Mary Kate, can you just walk me through where these accusations came from and how this all led to yesterday?
Well, these were from 24 massage therapists, mostly in the Houston area, who during from about the fall of 2020, they accused Deshaun Watson of sexual misconduct during massage appointments.
Most of the cases involved Watson exposing himself repeatedly, attempting to either touch or touching the women with his hands and penis.
And the first accuser that actually came forward was Ashley Solis.
I replay the incident over and over in my head as if I'm trying to wake up from some horrible nightmare. Only that nightmare is real.
She was recently on HBO. She did an interview talking about all of this. But she came forward and filed a suit, and then it just kicked off this string of what ultimately became 24 lawsuits against Deshaun Watson.
He requested that I work on his abdomen. But the moment I went above his navel, he told me he didn't want me to work there. He wanted me to work lower. He just kept directing me to go lower. And
he has maintained his innocence throughout.
I've never assaulted any woman. I never disrespected any woman. I was raised by a single-parent mom.
And so ultimately, these things were going to go to trial. All 24 of these were going to go to trial. 20 of the 24 have now been settled. This could mean sort of the beginning of the end of this whole saga.
Right. In these settlements, they're not assigning blame one way or the other. They're not saying he did it. They're not saying he didn't do it. But the plaintiffs basically agree not to go further with their lawsuit, and they generally agree not to talk about it anymore. However, critics of Watson have said, you know, 20 settlements with 20 different women does not scream nothing happened here. If you're Cleveland, if you're the NFL, can he play? Should he be playing this year? Like, what happens after nearly 24 settlements over sexual misconduct?
Well, first of all, the team has always 100% backed Deshaun Watson. They believe that he is innocent.
If we didn't get comfortable with Deshaun the person, it wouldn't have mattered how talented he was. We wouldn't have pursued the trade.
Now, Deshaun did admit the other day, I actually asked him this question. He did admit that he is now seeking some counseling, so he's taking advantage of the resources the Browns have made available. I think that will be a mitigating factor in the eyes of the NFL. But the NFL now must decide on the discipline for Deshaun Watson.
The personal conduct policy is something that's very important to us. And so the personal conduct policy does not need a criminal violation.
Sources have told me that the NFLPA, the Players Association, is bracing for a very long suspension, possibly up to a year. They plan to vigorously fight it. So that's the next big step that everyone has to cross, is to find out what the NFL has in mind and then how Deshaun's side will fight it.
I'm wondering about how fans are perceiving this, especially women fans in a sport that has tried to reach out to women in recent years. Like, what are the conversations you're hearing?
Well, I think a lot of fans are struggling with this whole situation and grappling with it as time has gone on after so many suits kept getting filed and there were interviews and it seemed like Tony Busby had all the momentum. So at that point, it was sort of, you know, 60% of fans that I would run into out on the street would say, geez, I don't know about this. I don't know where this is going. I don't know how I feel about this. And 40% were like, we're going to the Super Bowl and this is going to be great. So, you know, I think it'll probably land back somewhere in the middle now that 20 of these suits have been settled. It's going to be difficult out there in the court of public opinion, and they're going to have to walk this fine line between making it seem like They really do value, respect, and believe women who bring these things up, and also being fair to the fact that there is no evidence that anything happened.
Although, as the plaintiff's attorney has been saying for months now, not he said, she said, and then 23 other different women came forward saying, very similar thing happened to me. Mary Kay Cabot from the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. One more quick break. When we come back, hopefully the only thing you're hooked to is this show. But if not, you're going to want to hear this. One Last Thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. Nearly everyone who's ever been a regular smoker has a story about trying to quit. It's incredibly hard. But what if it just wasn't?
We want to help people stop this smoking, which is causing so much death and disability.
Yesterday, the FDA issued a groundbreaking announcement that for the first time, it wants to create a limit for how much nicotine you can put in a cigarette.
While nicotine is highly addictive, it's the burning tar and other byproducts inhaled through smoking that cause cancer, heart disease, and bronchitis.
To cancer doctors, this is huge. Remember, using tobacco or not remains the single biggest voluntary thing you can do to determine your cancer risk. If cigarettes had less nicotine, people would be able to choose to quit more easily. And the FDA says under this plan, nicotine levels would be so limited that cigarettes, by law, would be minimally addictive or even non-addictive.
For all those we lost, for all those we miss, we can end cancer as we know it.
If President Biden wanted a moonshot to reduce cancer deaths, well, this is probably the biggest cancer policy change we've ever seen. And yet, just because the FDA will push for this doesn't mean it's necessarily going to happen. It will take nearly a year to draw up the language. After that, it goes through a public comment stage, at which point it would likely face staunch opposition from powerful tobacco industry lobbyists.
In every generation, the tobacco industry has produced a new set of products, which they claim were less harmful. Until now, the major impact of the introduction and marketing of those products was to keep people smoking.
And if it's not ratified quickly, remember, this is still technically up to the executive branch. A new president could tell the FDA to stop working on it. Libertarian groups are already upset about this proposal. After all, this would effectively ban most cigarettes in the country that Americans currently enjoy. But cancer deaths are not necessarily a partisan issue. President Trump's pick to lead the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, was actually pushing for a similar rule. But this big of a change has never had this level of support from the White House, which is why until now, a lot of these efforts had gone up in smoke. It's like we always think of cigarettes as like these things that don't change, and we forget that like you literally could change them if you wanted to, or if there's a rule where you had to. A lot of news coming down on this new gun bill. Keep up to date with us on Twitter all day at Start Here ABC, or of course check in with abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.